You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment. You are about to see.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is a very special episode of Treasury Cast. Now, of course, normally we talk about the DC and Marvel treasuries of the 1970s and 1980s, but this time we are going all the way back to the 1940s to talk about one of the earliest examples of the Treasury Comics format, namely Charles Burroughs's Tops. Now, some of you, probably a lot of you, are wondering, what the hell is Charles Burroughs's Tops? And we'll get to all that, because we're here to talk about a new book by Fantagraphics called Tops, the complete collection of Charles Burroughs' visionary 1949 comic book series, with the author of the book and legendary comics pro, Michael T. Gilbert. Hi, Michael.
Well, howdy. How's it going there?
It's going great. I am bursting at the seams to talk to you about this book. I loved it so much, but I'm also just really thrilled to be talking to you. I've been buying your comics for a very long time. I don't want to make you feel old, but I've been buying your comics for a long time. So I'm just so excited to be talking to you.
Oh, thanks, Robert. I appreciate that.
Oh man, I remember buying Mr. Monster off the stands at the Comic Crypt in Oakland, New Jersey. And I was so excited. And I've loved that book ever since. So, Andy, you're here to talk about Tops. So let me give a little bit of context before we get into the book. So back in the early 2000s, when I started my Treasury Comics website, which was an attempt to catalog every Treasury edition ever published, the site's not available anymore, but I worked long and hard on it at the time. So I put it out, and right after it debuted, it got noticed by Mark Evanier, the great comic book writer, TV writer, Mark Evanier, and someone who I'm acquainted with.
And good man.
Good man. And he was very nice. He did a very nice plug of the site, just unprompted. And I was very touched that he would do that. And so he was talking about the treasuries and stuff like that. And he goes, said something to the effect of, Rob has listed here virtually every treasury I could think of, except for a couple, and Charles Burroughs's Tops. And I remembered at the time going, what the hell is Charles Burroughs's Tops? I had no idea what that was. So I had to do some research. And again, we'll get into the details of this, but it's a series that I have never been able to find because it is so rare and then consequently so expensive to find the original issues of. And it was the kind of thing that I thought, well, I'll just never get them. I'll just never own these. There's nothing else I can do. There's no way I'm ever going to get these. But now I have been able to read them thanks to this amazing book, which is brand new out from Fantagraphics. So, Michael, why don't you explain to people what was Tops?
Okay, it was a first attempt at a comic book specifically aimed at adults. It was by Charles Burroughs, published by Lev Gleason, and it came out in 1949. Now, Charles Burroughs had a major success with his comic book, Crime Does Not Pay. It was a crime comic in the 40s that, you know, sold millions of copies. He also was writing and editing the original Daredevil comics from the 40s before Marvel took over the name. So things like that. And he had been pushing his publisher for about 10 years, according to him, to publish a comic book aimed at adult, because the Crime Does Not Pay was aimed at a more adult audience, you know, soldiers or, you know, teenagers or whoever was interested in crime fiction, ostensibly based on true life stories, which was questionable, but some true life characters anyway, Pretty Boy Floyd and things like that. So finally, his publisher said, okay, you know, you've been bugging me all these years, go ahead and do it. So they came up with this thing called Tops, and Burroughs envisioned full painted covers. It was going to be 64 pages. It was going to be Treasury size, Life magazine size. And they were aiming stories that would appeal to all sorts of adults. There would be some romantic fiction for the ladies. There would be advice columnists. There would be two-fisted action stories, crime stories for the guys. They had stories like, political things like, how would you live under a one-world government? I mean, boy, that's a snooze fest, but there you go.
Presented by Melvin Douglas, of all things.
By Melvin Douglas, the actor, right. they had another one where they said, you are the jury. And they would have this article where they would have, they would explain this case. This guy's coming up for parole, and they show his crime and what he's done since then. And they ask, what would you do? Would you let him off, or would you keep him in jail? And things like that, really unusual for the times. Or even today, for that matter.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so they tried this, and it was a notorious flop, right? Because it lasted all of two issues with a third that was supposedly prepared, but didn't even make it out to the third?
Well, I'm not even sure they prepared a third one. They were planning to, but I don't know whether they actually did any work on it. And supposedly, according to Charles Byrow years later, he said that that sales actually had been increasing, and maybe if they had given it more than two issues, perhaps it would have succeeded. But it was a very tough sell because it was such a large size. You wouldn't necessarily rack it with the comic books. You wouldn't necessarily rack it with the magazines. So they really didn't know where to put it. And it was hurt by that a great deal, I think.
Right. It was sort of a neither fish nor fowl kind of thing. The price point was a little higher than the standard comic, or actually, significantly higher when you think about
it. Comics were 10 cents and this was 25 cents per.
Yeah.
So you can get 2.5 copies, for a reissue of Tops.
Yeah. Now, why do you think, like I said, it didn't succeed because it was either neither fish nor fowl. Before, I want to talk about the book and the collecting of it, but where do you come into this in terms of what was your read on this material when did you first get to see these books, and what was your read on it when you got it, when you actually got a chance to read these stories?
Okay. Well, I first heard about Tops. There was a graphic story magazine, a very upscale visionary fanzine from 1967. And Bill Spicer wrote a long article on Tops, what it was and why it failed. And it intrigued me. I mean, it just sounded like a really fascinating story. And he had some examples of some of the artwork by Reed Crandall, who was always a favorite of mine from EC Comics on. And I kept my eye out for many years, hoping to get a copy. I'd go to conventions. And once in a great while, I'd see a copy that was just, way too expensive for me to have. anything more than $5 was more expensive than I could afford most of the time. But and this went on for years and years. I would sometimes see it at conventions, and maybe even have a chance to glance through it quickly at the dealer's table or something. But I was dying to read it, just like you were. And finally, last year, someone was mentioning that they had a copy of Topps Comics and this and that. And I said, hey, if I come up with a reason to reprint it, if I say, let's see if we can pitch a book reprinting this, maybe I can get these guys to lend me the comic, I can scan them, and more important, I can read them. And that's exactly what I did. And we had a couple of really nice pro fans, Roger Hill and George Hagenauer, also comic historians themselves. And they were willing to lend it to me, even though they knew it would be, damaged in the scanning, but they were willing to do that. So I did it as carefully as I could and sent it back to them immediately. And, then I set about to clean up the negatives. I had it in Photoshop and a high DPI and, started, restoring the artwork, where artwork was going, you know, the color went over the panels. Back when it was printed in the 40s, the printing wasn't the greatest, despite the aspirations of a professional adult magazine. The publisher didn't put the kind of money that it would take for really good paper and fully painted covers. They had to, you know, do line drawings instead. But with Photoshop, something that would have been inconceivable 20 years ago, I could go in there and very meticulously correct the misprints and sharpen the blacks, you know, and keep the whole feel of the original comic, but as it would have been had it been published as Charles Bureau had intended, with high quality paper and this. Once I had that, then I set about looking for a publisher. And the first one I approached was Fantagraphics, because they always do these very high-end books and such. And they were immediately intrigued. I think that Gary was also a super fan back in the 60s, and I'm sure he saw the original article that I saw and was intrigued. And we agreed to do it. I went down. I also, before I even sent it to him, I wrote some background information on Topps, the history of it, and such. So we had a lot to give him with the packaging before we even started.
Oh, wow. Okay, because I was curious as to where you came into it, whether the Topps book had been a project that was in development and then you came on later, but no, this was inspired by you. Okay, well, that's you're doing great work, Michael, for bringing that. That's such a fan notion of like, I just want to see these. Maybe I can pitch it as a book. You know, that's right. Such a great retrofitting of like, well, I already want this, so how can I sell somebody that way they can pay for it? But I am stunned at the notion that this was all that these images. And by the way, everybody, you'll be able to see some of the pages from this book on our website, FrontwaterPodcast.com. Fantagraphics was very kind enough to send me a PDF. And so you'll be able to see some of these glorious pages on the website, because you really want to take a look at these. But I'm stunned at you telling me that these were just scans from the original comics, because these things look absolutely flawless. I would have thought that you had somehow had the negatives, which I realize they're probably long gone. I mean, that's, you know, who would have kept those? But these look amazing. I can't believe that these are actually just scans from printed editions. They look gorgeous.
Well, thank you. The trick is, you know, I'm an artist myself. I'm a cartoonist, so I've done a lot of work with coloring and such. And all it takes is being willing to spend a lot of time doing it, you know, blowing a panel up and then, you know, cleaning this up, or, you know, changing the color of this small section and such. I'm glad that you think it looks as good as it does.
As I was reading it, I was saying to myself, okay, how do these look so good? And then, like I said, I was like, well, this must be, they must have had the negatives. And then I'm like, well, how can they possibly have the negatives in this thing? I mean, who would have kept those? But the idea that these would be scans that would have had to have been retouched page by page just seemed like such a Herculean labor that I was like, well, that can't be it either. You know, so, I should, you know, well, hats off to you.
That's one of the silver linings of the COVID, people staying in more, and I had more time to work on stuff like this.
My goodness. So what was your reaction when you finally got a chance to read these stories? When it's something that you've wanted to read for so, or see or whatever, hear whatever the piece of art is, for so long, and then you finally get it, sometimes it can be a little disappointing, because it's almost like it can't live up to the hype of what you have in your brain. I mean, you said you had a chance to look through them at conventions and stuff. I never had that. So, I mean, all of this was new to me. But what was your, as you finally got to read them, what was your impression about just the quality of the work?
Well, it's something of a mixed bag. I mean, the star of the show is the two Reed Crandall stories that Charles Bureau wrote. And they lived up to anything I could have hoped. It was just like EC crime suspense stories, except it was done 4 or 5 years before Reed Crandall was doing EC crime suspense stories. So it was just spectacular. George Tuska had a couple of stories I was never a huge fan of his work in the 70s, but I love his work in the 50s, and this was just top flight work and looked really great. Some impressive double page spreads and such. Bob Fugitani had some great stories. He was one of the last surviving people. He died about a year or so ago. But beautiful work. Some of the stories were, and some stories are really fascinating. You know, that's the way it's going to be when you get something that's 70 odd years old.
And certainly meant to, as you talked about, trying to appeal to everybody, that it has stuff for everybody. It's got kind of like, there's gag material. There's these crime comics. There's, there's romance. I mean, there's like advice columns. It's just got a little bit of everything. And so you can understand the idea of like, we're going to make this a nice big glossy package. It's going to look like a Life magazine, and let's make it as broad based so everybody picks it up. But I guess the problem, of course, is if you make it so broad based, you miss everybody because somebody who wants to buy a crime comic and is going to buy it for the crime story is not going to drop a quarter just to get one crime story and a bunch of stuff they don't want when they could spend 10 cents and get Crime Does Not Pay.
Right. In a certain way, I mean, someone else mentioned this. What might have been a better way to start would be to do the magazine section, this format of A Crime Does Not Pay, except you could put that with the detective magazines at that point, opposed to the comic books. But they had ambitions and they thought this was the way to go. I don't know if anything would have worked at that point. If you had a number of books coming out at the same time in the same format, then they might have had a place to display it and something to look for, but they didn't. They just had this one comic book.
A lot of this stuff reminded me of, I mean, I haven't read this stuff extensively, but I've read it enough to feel like I have some handle on it. A lot of the material reminded me of the EC Pictofiction line, where it was like they were trying to get away, of course, after the heat of the Comics Code and all that stuff of Wortham, they were trying to kind of, make the stuff a little more societally palatable. And I always found the Picto Fiction stuff to be beautifully illustrated because it's all the same EC people, but the stories are just kind of pallid. Like they're just kind of, especially compared to what they were doing in Tales from the Crypt and crime suspense stories, the stories are just kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, that was nice, but it's you're just like, this isn't EC. So it in a lot of ways, it feels like it's like the top stuff is like, it's too sophisticated for children, but it's not kind of lurid enough, I think, for an adult to want to kind of try it. And so, yeah, it does kind of fall in that weird, like one story that I specifically wanted to mention, just because I was completely unfamiliar with the artist, Goldmine in a Sewer.
Yes.
Drawn by Louis Jambor. I'm not familiar with this person at all, but his work reminded me a lot of Geoff Darrow's stuff, where it's like very few blacks and just very incredibly detailed line work. And it's beautiful to look at. Like every page looks like an old timey magazine illustration, but I thought the story like almost put me to sleep. Like it was so kind, but it was so beautiful to look at. It kind of didn't mind, but I can imagine in 1949, nobody's going to drop a quarter for that.
Well, I disagree about the story itself. I thought it was very interesting because I think it was a true life story about some guy who would go into the sewers to find gold that fell out there. And some of these people would die of sewer gas until he found a way to avoid that. As far as Louis Jambor, he had a relatively small comic book career. In fact, that three-page thing that you saw is the only comic book work he ever did.
Wow.
I think he colored both issues of Topps. He went on to a career doing murals, a very famous mural painter, which
that
makes
sense.
I didn't realize any of that until I started looking up all. I made the big mistake, and when I put this together, of saying I'm going to do a biography of all 50 creators, and I didn't realize what a job that would turn out to be. But that's how I found out about him.
I appreciated that because again, a lot of these people I was not familiar with, and I really loved some of your bios where you were like, I couldn't find anything on this person. I don't know. I thought that was like, I admired the honesty of like, look, we tried, you know, I don't know.
We look.
Yeah.
We only didn't get about, you know, five or six. So we got amazing. A pretty fair amount.
Absolutely. Especially, you got to think about how many people use pseudonyms to do comics too. I mean, it's even harder to be like, maybe it was this guy, maybe it was somebody else. One of the other stories I did want to mention art-wise, and by the way, I was maybe being a little harsh on the Goldmine in a Sewer, but the Nine Lives of Citizen Train by Willis Thornton. First of all, I love, and I'm a huge Citizen Kane fan, so anything that has, I feel like, is some sort of oblique reference to Citizen Kane makes me, my eyes perk up a little. But there's this great motif going through the story. The top of the page features nine cats, and as each life of this guy is eliminated, one of the cats gets an X put across it. And so you're going through page by page, and each cat is getting another X, another. And I just thought, what an imaginative motif for this story to throw in. And it's not something you really would have seen in a kind of a kid's comic, that kind of thing. I thought that was just terrific.
Yeah, I thought it was a very, very impressive little graphic detail. That makes the story for me, just that alone.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought they did a great job.
Yeah. You mentioned George Tuska doing Times Square Interlude. And that is terrific. That's one of those things where, having grown up on comics, superhero comics in the 70s and 80s, I was seeing George Tuska's stuff in the 80s when he was doing superhero work, which I don't think was his jam. You know, I think he was doing it.
I didn't think he was suited for that at all, even though he was very popular at it, but yeah. I didn't care for it.
He was doing it to stay employed, which is understandable, but I would look at it and go, really, this guy? And then I would go back and look at his crime comics and go, oh, now I get it. Like the crime, you know, the crime comics went out of favor and he had to keep working, but man, the crime comic stuff is great. It's actually really beautiful stuff.
Well, the thing about George Tuska is that his style was very reality based, and he was really good doing ordinary people.
Right.
When he went to Marvel in the 60s, you know, Stan Lee said, okay, draw like Kirby. So he drew like Kirby, you know, and it worked. You know, he was very popular. He was probably one of their best selling artists, but I thought he was ill suited for it.
Yeah. It's really, really beautiful stuff. Again, when you see it at this size, another one I loved was, Hatcheck. The opening story of the second issue, illustrated by Reed Crandall. And you mentioned this in your notes. It's like, it is aside from the horrendous, racist caricature of the bad guy in it. But I mean, the story of this woman who is stalked by a customer at this restaurant that she works at, and no one can help her. The police can't help her. And like, it's startlingly prescient and very empathetic for what this woman is going through. Is not something you would have expected to read in a comic book in 1949.
Yeah, it seemed ahead of its time. You know, I thought the ending was a little too facile, but aside from that, it really, they were able to give a feeling of terror and how upsetting it would be to be that. And Reed Crandall's artwork was so spot on. He was able to make it really bring it to life in a way that few other artists could have.
Yeah. I feel like if that had been in crime suspense story at EC, like it would have ended with that guy getting like his head chopped off or something like that.
Right.
Could have been, it's just missing that one piece of real lurid detail that made the ECs kind of what they were.
Right. Or the girl who's being, follow would be the one who actually had the whole thing planned and would kill him at the end.
Yeah, right. The twist at the end, you find out she's the actual murderer or something like that. Yeah, exactly. So one of the things that I was so thrilled at, and this is just coming from someone who loves the Treasury format, and I'm a giant nerd for the format, that's why I do the show, is when this book was released, right? First of all, I had heard that it was getting reprinted, and I thought, oh, great, I'll finally get a chance to read these stories. That's exciting. You know, what an obscure piece of comics history to put in a hardcover, and I was so excited. But when I saw that it was done at the Treasury size, Michael, I mean, I fell in love at that point, the cartoon hearts, because so much of modern Treasury material that when it's reprinted now is reprinted at normal size. It's not. DC's been doing some occasional reprints of their classic Treasuries at Treasury size. But for the most part, the reprints get just put in regular trade because the Treasury format is still kind of considered not terribly popular. It's ungainly, you know, whatever, whatever, whatever. So was reprinting them at this size always part of the equation in terms of the book?
Yes, it was. Actually, first of all, when I told you I was asking a couple of people to borrow their things so I could scan them, Roger Hill said he would do it, but he wanted it reprinted hardcover and large size. And
I love these guys.
Yeah, me too. Well, this was my dream too. So that wasn't anything. So when I approached Gary Groth at Fantagraphics about doing this, I said, this is how it has to be. And he was fine with it. I was just thrilled. You know, he was very encouraging. And he, as I say, I'm sure he saw the same fanzine article back in 1967, and I'm sure he's been dying to read these all of these years later. So yeah, that wasn't the problem.
That's marvelous. I mean, I guess part of it is these pages, this artwork that was done. I mean, they were intended to be printed that big. And so if you tried to condense them into a regular comic book page,
you lose all the detail. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it would be almost unreadable. I mean, I think about this as one story, Escape, adapted to Illustory, by the way, I love that phrase, Illustory, by Bill Kofed? I'm sorry, how do you pronounce
Kofed,
that?
Kofed, I think, yeah.
Kofed. I mean, trying to reduce all the detail, all the period detail, you know, in down to 8.5 by 11, just would have killed it. So that's right. Marvelous that this stuff was always intended to be that side. That it's just like, well, the kind of person who's going to want to read this is going to want to read it at this size. So let's just go all the way.
And that's how Charles Biro wanted it. You know, this is his vision, and we wanted it to be, what if Charles Biro had his comic book, except it was the way he actually envisioned it? If it was large size, good paper, you know, treated with the respect that an adult audience would give it. So we did that.
Now, he lived long enough, because he's interviewed in that that piece in the 60s, right? I think I remember.
Right.
He's like, so he lived long enough for, obviously not for this thing to be revived, but he lived long enough to know that people had grown up and remembered it and were at least giving it like its critical due, which I thought was nice that he was able, it wasn't just completely forgotten.
Yeah, it was great because he wrote a letter the following issue after that article appeared talking about it. I should mention that original article we have reprinted in the Topps book,
right.
And we also have Charles Biro's response to it. And he said, you know, basically you were accurate about a lot of things here, but here's a few behind the scene things that were going on that you couldn't know about, you know, about how he had envisioned this book as this, you know, expensive high class thing they were putting together. But then the publisher said, well, we want you to do it for the same price as your usual 10 cent comic. And you know, he said we knew we were screwed at that point. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Lev, it is kind of amazing that considering what a huge hit Crime Does Not Pay, which one was the bigger seller? Was it Crime Does Not Pay or Crime and Punishment? I always get those.
Crime Does Not Pay, that came first, and it was the better one.
That's the more lurid one, right? That's the one
right.
That's got
they're
all
both
the,
lurid, but yeah.
Okay. It is kind of interesting that they didn't think, as you mentioned earlier, to just do that. At a bigger size, like try that, and just because that had a brand name already. I mean, Topps, like top, even the word Topps is a weird. Like, what is that? Is that is it that mean it's the best? It's a name that doesn't tell you much about what the content is. And so, yeah, and like you were talking about with the budget, they didn't have a budget to do it. Like this thing was kind of behind the eight ball right from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they put the best efforts regardless. So.
And you got that cover. The cover of the first issue was very strange with this woman holding her head kind of like, oh, and there's a car seemingly racing behind her. And there's
it's a weak cover. I had to admit that.
Yeah. The second one is a lot better. The more sort of evocative
I like that one.
The
more lurid also. Yeah.
Yeah, it's more lurid, the woman being stalked. And, of course, they were trying, like the stories, you mentioned this, like the I'll buy that girl. And, you know, there's this beautiful woman and all these guys in business suits kind of leering at her, illustrated by the great Dan Barry. And that you know, that title sounds, ooh, this is going to be saucy. And then you get it and you're like, oh, it's not really, that's not really what it is.
I'll buy that girl. And it turns out to be she's a fashion model. And yeah.
Yeah. So now this is, I mean, this obviously this is hard to imagine because it's, you know, who knows, but do you think that, is it just that they were ahead of their time? Was it the contents? Do you think, I mean, do you think that maybe if they had tried this a little later, it might have been a bigger success, or was it just there were so many forces against it that it was, you know, it was probably never going to succeed, no matter.
Well, if they tried it 60 years later, they might have had a chance with it. But, they're really, I think that it was a shot at the moon. But you know, a few years later, they had Harvey Kurtzman did a similar attempt with a humor magazine called, unfortunately named Trump magazine.
Yeah.
In the late 50s.
The Hugh Hefner backed one.
The Hugh Hefner was publishing it, and it was gorgeous, full color, painted artwork and everything else here. And it only lasted two issues also because Hefner ran into some commercial problems, some financial problems at that point, and they had to cut back on their money, and they said, we're going to do this. That could have been another thing that potentially could have reached that kind of audience, a magazine audience or a larger audience. And Topps had the same thing, except they didn't have the deep pockets that Heft did.
It makes me think about, again, seeing it at this, again, at the size, it's just absolutely glorious. By the way, I love that you, all the pages that are the reprinting of the actual comic are tinted to the newsprint color.
Yeah.
I think that's such a marvelous touch because when you see stuff from an earlier age and it's on that bright white, it almost doesn't look right because we're so used to seeing newsprint at that slightly tan tint to it.
Yeah, and then that was one of the things when I was putting the pages together. You scan the stuff and you have the tan-looking pages in the original thing here. But if I just reproduced each of the pages like that, there wouldn't have been a consistency throughout the whole book. So I got the same color and I got rid of all the outside border colors and added this instead. So it looks similar, but it's consistent throughout the entire book.
Wow. What a Herculean labor that had to have been, man. I mean, that's really appreciate that kind of work for it. I mean, do you, again, when I'm looking it over, you know, you reprint that Daredevil story. Right,
yeah.
Which gets revised into the Topps version, and they took Daredevil out.
We printed a story in Topps that was a redone version of a Daredevil story that had happened a year earlier. Except they took Daredevil out and they just made a straight crime story.
By the way, the Daredevil story is really funny because it sort of ends with Daredevil not really having done anything. And he's like, well, I guess that worked out. What a strange.
Which is why it's so easy to convert it, because he really wasn't
here. He doesn't do anything in the story. I thought, what an incredibly passive superhero. It's just kind of like, well, then I didn't have to do anything. I'm just standing here in my red and blue costume looking weird. I love that the guy loses his hands. It's really neat to see the same story in two different ways. You know, like, that's really kind of cool. Like, wow, it's the same exact story beats, but just with different people going through the paces. I thought that was
different dialogue,
really
yeah.
neat. Yeah, it's kind of like when you see like a TV version of what becomes a movie later. You're like, wow, it's the same. You know, like there's a version of 12 Angry Men that was done before the movie on television, and it's the same script. And you're like, wow, this is all the same people, all the same characters saying all the same things, but coming out of different faces. It's just very, very strange. I wanted to ask you was Do you think that they maybe working in one of their superheroes might have, or do you think this would have been too discordant for what they were trying to do? Is like they were trying to make it more for adults and sticking a superhero in it might have been not the way to go. But at the same time, it's like they're trying to appeal to everybody. Maybe they could have, I mean, because Daredevil was at least an established character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, you know, that wasn't their intent. I mean, you know, conceivably, you know, if this had taken off, and they had gotten more books after that, then you can experiment with, you know, the large size Daredevil or, you know, well, at that, this was 1949, so superheroes were already almost on their way out at this point. There were very few, and they're being canceled every which way. Daredevil himself was being replaced by his kid sidekicks, the little wise guys, a bunch of kid group, taking over the comic. So I don't think that would have worked at that point. But and there had been, you know, there had been earlier attempts at doing large size superheroes. Fawcett had, let's see, what was the what was their comic? Master Comics, I think.
Oh, right. Master Comics was oversized. That's right.
Yeah. Right. Fiction House had Jumbo Comics.
Mm-hmm.
And within a few few issues, they were all put down to regular comic book size. So that obviously wasn't an easy sell.
Yeah. Do you have any idea of like how many tops are actually out there? I mean, I've never seen them. I've never seen one. On eBay, you talked about seeing them at a convention. I've never seen one actually for sale in any context. Do you have any clue from your research of like how many of them actually survived?
If I were to guess, and it's just a guess, I'd say a couple hundred. I don't know.
Wow. Yeah.
But now anybody can read them with a $50 bill in their pocket.
I mean, like I said, I am astounded that, that there's a market for this, to be honest with you. Like, I just try to think of what kind of, you know, obsessive comic book nerds would want to read this, but I'm so glad it exists because it is such an amazing document of comics at the time. Again, all of the historical context that you give it, I thought was as interesting as the material itself, because I just thought it was so, you know, this idea that like, hey, we're really going to try something different and we're going to put a lot of different hands involved in it. I mean, that's the other thing too, is like, I remember reading this in magazines years ago, like, you know, in the up until the 80s when anthologies really went away, you know, comics were a lot of anthology formats, but readers don't realize that anthologies are 10 times as hard to put together because you're dealing with 4 or 5 creative teams. You're dealing with 4 or 5 sets of deadlines as opposed to one, you know, if you're doing one comic book, that's 30 pages and you're dealing with a writer and an artist and an inker and a colorist. Well, now times 5, if you're doing 5 stories, and these tops books, I mean, they've got like what, like 30 features in an issue. I mean, just the organizational heft of this had to be overwhelming.
Oh yeah. You don't have to tell me. When I was doing my Mr. Monster comics back in the 80s, sometimes I would have, you know, 3, 4, or 5 Mr. Monster stories, each with a separate storyline, sometimes different artist, splash page, different lettering, you know. So yeah, it's exponentially more difficult to do that. But getting point to a point about who's going to buy these in the first place, it certainly wasn't something I was losing a lot of sleep over, but I just wanted to do it. But it seems to me in the year 2022, there were a lot of comic book college courses and such, and this is the first, you know, comic book specifically aimed at adults, and so, you know, there's something to be teaching right there. And of course there are, you know, older collectors, and there's a number of collectors who saw that original 1967 story and for 50 years have said, you know, I'd like to read that comic. So now they have the chance.
Yeah. Oh man, it's just unbelievable stuff. A couple other stories I wanted to mention before we wrap up here. The Summer Waitress, drawn by Fred Kida, and features an absolutely gorgeous double page spread, which is, I mean, when you reprint it at this size, it's just so unbelievable. Now, do you happen to know, again in your research, like, did any of this original artwork ever surface or survive? Have you ever seen any of the original pieces for any of this stuff?
I think on Heritage there may be 2 or 3 pages from Tops, possibly one of the Tuska pages. I'm not sure if they kept it in their own collection and then sold it years later, but hardly any. No,
man. I mean, and do you happen to know, was this stuff done? Because most people know comic book original art is done, I think, what, like 2 up from the actual page size when it's actually reprinted. I mean, were these done at Treasury size and then printed at 100%, or were they done even bigger and then shrunk down a little bit from that?
I'm guessing they were done the usual size, but I don't really know.
Okay. All right. Because, I mean, man, I mean, some of the, I mean, like, again, looking at that double page spread, I mean, again, some of the line work that is so detailed in these pages. And I just think, oh my God, these guys just have slaved over these things. By the way, I love that you managed to reprint even like the original ads.
Oh,
things
yeah.
Like that. I mean, there's a Lifesavers ad in there. I mean, I'm guessing most of these, I mean, Lifesavers is still around, but most of these companies, I guess, are no longer with us. So you didn't, was there any, did you run into any sort of, is there any sort of copyright issues you have to worry about, that kind of stuff? Or is it, that's just null and void at this point?
I think it's null and void at this point. Okay. We didn't have any concerns.
Okay. I love the, again, the biographical end notes. I thought that was, you know, really interesting. I love all the little inset photos of all the artists that work on it. I mean, again, you've got some female artists, which was, you know, still relatively unusual at that time.
And I was really trying to find out information on Virginia, but she was a writer at Charles Biro's thing here, one of the major writers. And I found some biographical information on her, but could not for life of me find a photograph anywhere. But she was a major writer working with Charles Biro, ghosting a lot of his stories. Virginia Hubble.
Okay, so. Virginia Hubble. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these people probably use pseudonyms and stuff because comics was sort of not. You know, for a lot of these people, it was a stepping stone to other careers.
Right. And as long as we're talking about women, let me also mention the beautiful design work of the Topps book collection was done by Fantagraphics with this woman named Keelan McCarthy, who I thought just did a spectacular job. I gave her, you know, the rough layout for the book, but then she went in here, did the typography, and did that gorgeous cover. Put, you know, I had actually had a different cover intended, but she came up with this, and it was just so much better than what I had come up with. And I said, it's great. And I should also mention that our editor was Conrad Groth, Gary's son, and he did a really great job too. He's very, very helpful throughout the whole thing. It was a very pleasant experience working there.
That's great, because I said it's just a gorgeous edition. I mean, I sat and I read it, and I read it in kind of a couple of chunks because it's dense. You know, I mean, it's a dense read.
You get your money's worth.
Oh my goodness, yes. But I mean, it's so complete. I didn't know before I ordered it. I ordered it like a year ago, you know, and then I sort of forgot about it. And then I was like, Amazon was like, oh hey, we're shipping Topsy next month. I was like, oh my God, I forgot that I ordered it. This is great. But I didn't realize that it was going to come with all this material by you and the other people that helped you put the book together, like all of this biographical material, again, of the people, the context, Lev Gleason, Charles Biro, I mean, all of the stuff. And so that to me is like, it makes it so much more of a complete piece that it's like, wow, here's this weird little history, little part of history of the Treasury Comics format. And now it's everything you would possibly want to know about this. I mean, it's just absolutely fascinating. So, I mean, anyone out here who's listening, again, you can check out some of the pages on the website, frontorderpodcast.com. But I would absolutely recommend, if you're a fan of comics history, go and check this book out. Because I said, it's just an utterly fascinating read. And one last thing I do want to ask you about this book before we wrap up, Michael.
Sure.
There's a photo right at the introduction of Charles Biro. And it says, Charles Biro at New York WOR radio station promoting Topps number one. And it's this photo of him in front of a microphone holding the first issue. Now, Do you know what that's about? Like, did he read stories from it? Do you know what that is?
It was a radio interview, and I imagine they were taking a publicity shot. That was why he was holding that.
Is there any inkling that exists anywhere, that audio? I mean, boy, I would love to hear that.
Oh, yeah, I haven't heard that it exists. If it had, I'm sure I would have been quoting from it.
Yeah. Oh my, that photo really made my, I was like, what? Like, is it like a Charles Barrow? Like, he's reading Topps comics over the air? Wow.
I think that was so cool. Yeah. Who knows? He might have said some things, sort of, you know, some excerpts from the comic itself, but no one knows.
Oh man, boy, that would have been that would have been really, really cool to hear. So, well, one other thing I do want to ask you before we wrap up, which is not connected to Topps exactly. So, are you a particular fan of the Treasury format? Do you have some in your collection? Did you buy them when they were coming out?
Yeah, certainly I was buying the Treasury things when they came out. If it was something that I actually, you know, cared about, mm-hmm. you know, if it was a Barry Smith Conan at that size. Yes, let's see all the detail by all means. They were just fun. you know, 30 years ago, Mark Morton had his 20 Nudes 20 humorous thing done in that giant format and good paper. Tundra put it out. It was very interesting. You know, there's this, I think it's a cool format. And, you know, I'd like to see more of it for material that's worthy of it.
Speaking of, well, speaking of material that's worthy of it, we are ever going to get a Mr. Monster Drudgery Edition? I mean, come on, Michael, what are we doing?
Well,
I would love that.
Well, who can say? I mean, we certainly see these art portfolio books, you know, shy from the original artwork, you know, the ECR, these EC versions and things like that. So there may be a Mr. Monster one of these days.
Oh, believe, yeah, I'll buy as many of them as I can afford, because that would be, I've always loved that character, I've always loved that comic, I've always loved your work, and I just, you know, as I go on and on about every episode of the show, I'm like, there's always some artists that I feel like their work has just never been seen at that size, and I'm like, you know, there's always like that list of like, you know, there's never been like a, you know, like a Walt Simonson Thor at a Treasury site, you know, that kind of thing, like somebody, and I would, man, a Mr. Monster Treasury would just be like, no, chef's kiss, you know, it'd be the absolute thing. So I, you know, I'll put down, I'm raising my hand. I'm voting for that big time if that ever can ever happen.
All right. So, sounds good.
So, well, again, Michael, thank you so much for doing this. I'm just so honored to get to talk to you. And I'm just so amazed that this book even exists, that someone would think to put it all together, that again, just such a labor of love, and that the Fantagraphics would help you, you know, partner with you and really just pull out all the stops, because it's just an absolutely gorgeous book. And I have it here on my treasury shelf, and it is just such a gorgeous addition to it. So thank you so much for doing this book, and thank you so much for talking with me. I'm just really honored to be able to get a chance to do this.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was a pleasure talking to you.
All right. Well, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. I want you to stay tuned. I'm going to run some podcast promos, and when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
You're listening to Prairie Justice, a Greg Sanders Vigilante podcast.
Is an exploration of the DC Comics character, the first superhero to use the name of the Vigilante. First published in Action Comics 42 in September 1941, amid comics' golden age and carried as a continuous feature, during those years the Vigilante was also a member of the Seven Soldiers of Victory, and was one of the first DC heroes to appear on the cinema screen in his own serial. Reappearing in the Bronze Age, the Vigilante had a 1970s renaissance throughout the DC universe. Greg Sanders, the Prairie Troubadour, leads a double life as a modern country and western musician, while also delivering justice throughout North America as a masked crime fighter, using the tactics and weapons of his rural Wyoming upbringing. With his friends Billy Gunn and Stuff Leong, many a nefarious scheme was foiled with six guns, ingenuity, a motorcycle, and a twirling lariat. Howdy, I'm Ranger Gord. Help me follow the trail of the Vigilante on Podbean, Apple Podcasts, and Google Play.
Greetings, guys and ghouls. I'm the Invisible Dan Colon, and this is The Monsters That Made Us. Join Monster Mike Manzi and I on the last Friday of every month as we celebrate all of the spooktacular characters and films in the Universal Studios classic monster series. From the Phantom of the Opera to The Creature Walks Among Us, we sink our teeth into all the gory details as we dissect the films that gave us some of the most iconic movie monsters of all time. The Monsters That Made Us is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more information, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
And it's time for listener feedback. And these are the comments we got on the website, findwaterpodcast.com. For TreasureCast episode number 66, Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, with my guest, Sarah Century. First up is from our very own network, Siskoid, who says, on the question of how the leader is chosen, their constitution prescribes regular elections, with the second most vote getter becoming deputy leader. The early stories had a sort of randomizer doing it, like panel to panel, but it soon became straight one legionnaire, one vote. A number of them were actually decided by readers, especially in the internet era. It led to some crazy stories, like when Saturn Girl fixed the election so she would be leader to face a certain threat. Stop the steal. Wildfire was elected leader despite not winning the most votes because the winner, Superboy, was not a full-time legionnaire. If you wonder why he ran anyway, he didn't. You can vote for any Legionnaire, even if they don't campaign for votes. So those voters didn't read their constitution too closely. More things change, more things stay the same. Sarah is correct. The Cosmic Boy is default leader because if something happens that we're in between elections and leaderless, the leader role reverts to him, or if unavailable, either the two founders, Saturn Girl and Lightning Lad. Yeah, that's how the Fire and Water Network works. Jeff R. says in response to that, I'm fairly sure Wildfire was a reader-elected leader, an unexpected one that the writers never really knew what to do with. And Siskoid responds, correct. It explains why Superboy actually won. The votes were in character and why it never worked. And then Captain Entropy goes, God, there's so much talk about the Legion bylaws here. This is fascinating stuff. Captain Entropy says, great, put up or shut up opportunity, though. Let's the loudmouth complainer see how difficult the job really is. Yeah, that's what happened when we elected Shag leader of the network for a brief time. We don't want to talk about it. Rob McCarthy says, it's not important enough to be rule number one, but it's like rule number four. Any long-running superhero story that does not happen now has time travel. Also remember, Wildfire doesn't really have a body. Bitter kids in wheelchairs love the guy. He's sort of kind of their Ben Grimm. As a very casual Legion fan, you can only sell something based on Superboy so hard because Superboy will not die. I know two things. One, the Miracle Machine can do anything. Two, Matter Lab just ate it once and went nuts. Anybody else aching for a Hulk-Legion crossover? Dream with me. One, Type Trapper is clearly Kang, right? Two, Kang kidnaps Hulk, like he did a freaking lot to kill the original three. Three, Hulk has fought Superman three times, but he's never fought Superboy. Could he kill him? What does that do to space-time? Whoa. And then Captain Entropy comes back responding to that. Rob, that's all I ever knew about the Miracle Machine too. I think I learned from this treasury. I would happily buy and read your crossover. Absolutely. Long as it was in treasury size. Ito Bosnar says, oh yeah, what a great treasury to talk about. Even more than the first Legion treasury. I wanted this one so much based on that cover, which I only saw and gazed at longingly in house ads. Alas, as I noted in the comments to your coverage of that other treasury, neither of them showed up in any magazine racks that I normally haunted when I was on the prowl for comics. As for the content of this book, and specifically the art, although I occasionally find myself defending Coletta's inks, I'll readily agree that he did Grell's work no favors here based on the images in your gallery post. I agree it would have been much better if Grell had done the inking himself, or even better, Terry Austin had done it, because that way we would have gotten a cameo appearance by Olive Oil or Flash Gordon. Well, despite all this, I hope Sarah enjoys her hardcover reprint of the book once it arrives. Me too, Adam. Joe X says, known to Legion fans as that damn tabloid, due to the difficulty in finding it at all, and then in a decent condition. They will store easily in a standard briefcase. Ooh, very Pulp Fiction. Jeff R. says, way back in the Usenet era, this book was known as TDT, that damn tabloid, impossible to find, and if you did find it, impossible to store, try a suitcase, and yet containing two developments of long-term Legion interest, the wedding itself, sort of, we never do see the wedding as it happens in the real timeline, and the Time Trapper as controller business. Maybe three, sort of since this kind of thing is by the time T-Beacon gets built. I didn't get to read it until a few years ago when it was reprinted in one of the Superboy and the Legion trades, so not proper sized even at that. You know, Jeff, I didn't even really think about that, that, you know, in the era of newsstand distribution, not being able to find a special book was actually could be kind of a problem. And if you were a Legion collector, that would be really annoying that this big story, this big event happened in a, you know, in somewhere where you couldn't get it. Now, you know, of course, once comic shops came along and we could get everything and things started being traded, that's a different scenario. But yeah, I would have been, if they had done that original Justice League treasury that they were planning on doing by Conway and Rich Buckler, and I had not been able to find that, I would have driven me nuts because I love the JLA and I would have been mad that I couldn't get it. So thank you for that. I never really considered that. And we didn't talk about that on the show. Matt Saroy says, fun episode. I also struggled to enjoy the Legion of Superheroes. I tried to get into the title on several occasions since I enjoyed team books due to getting several superheroes all together. Unfortunately, no matter how I tried, I always felt like I was late to the party and left out of the conversation. For years, I thought it was due to my unfamiliarity with the characters, but I was also unfamiliar with the vast majority of All-Star Squadron and never had any trouble following that book. Oh well, DC and Marvel certainly gave me plenty of other books to enjoy. Now I'd like to raise a glass at DC for reprinting these beloved treasuries and helping to preserve the format and the original stories presented in them. Agree there, Matt. I think DC is doing great work with these hardcover deluxe editions. I wish they would do more of them. I'd buy every one. Captain Entropy says, I really, really enjoyed this episode. Thank you. Rob, you were excellent as always, despite your apathy towards the material. And Sarah Century, great name, was a delight. This is the second most important treasury in my personal pantheon, surpassed only by the superb Superman versus Muhammad Ali. And yes, I accept that the story is bonkers. That's part of the appeal. I shall elaborate. All right, everybody, sit down and get ready. My parents bought this for me when it came out, either in response to my pleading or because they saw it and picked it up. I can just imagine their hearts swelling with affection for me and their minds eagerly anticipating the hours of silence this comic would bring. Money was tight in the 70s, but oh my, was this worth it. I was but a wee bairn, neither big enough to ride any of the good rides or old enough to tie my shoes. However, thanks to good parenting, good schooling, and good comics, I was beginning to read a little. I, of course, was already a huge Superman fan, but who is this Superboy? And the Legion of Superheroes in the 30th century? This was an unknown world to explore. Over the next few years, I returned to the story again and again so I could almost follow it, which is where I still am today. I studied and referenced the bonus material again and again just so I could follow additional Legion comics. For me, this comic worked exactly as Sarah surmised it would, a spectacular sampler and primer that enabled me to understand Legion comics and encouraged me to buy them for years. I eventually got rid of my original copy because the cover was gone and the newsprint was torn and folded like a true tabloid. But thanks to this podcast and a gift card, I have a hardcover replacement on the way. A few more random points. Time Trapper. In my heart, Time Trapper will always be a controller. This is where I learned what a controller is. Also, no comments on the costume. He cribbed it from Destiny, or actually vice versa. Regardless, the design was phoned in and Destiny wore it better. Finally, being defeated by Gleek does not diminish the Time Trapper as a threat. People underestimate Gleek at their peril. The wedding. Of course they went to the wedding before they solved the crisis and defeated the bad guy. I thought this was one of the most sensible decisions in the story. When the resolution requires time travel and there's no immediate threat to one's ability to time travel, the problem is not really that urgent. A wedding ceremony, regardless of its importance on a cosmic scale, is always urgent. All the guests are waiting, and the shrimp at the reception hall only has so long before it goes bad. Those are truths you will soon be made aware of, Mr. Kelly. I'm already there, Captain. That's it for now. Thanks for covering this. I've literally waited years, but the payoff was worth it. Thank you. Dr. Ann says, love the Legion. Like many, I've never seen this tabloid in the wild, and I don't own it. I suppose I will need to rectify that now that it has been re-released. But dang, Coletta really strips Grell down to the studs. The pages are just so lifeless. The Time Trapper was a controller, was the living embodiment of inertia, was even Cosmic Boy once. I don't know what any of that means. The real Trapper could have never been beaten by Gleek. Always liked him more as a cosmic being than something as mundane as a rogue controller. Great show. Great to hear Sarah talk about the Legion. Chris Franklin from our network, of course, has fun discussion. I remember ads for this in some of my earliest comics. I don't think I've ever laid eyes on the real thing, but from the sounds of things, copies are pretty scarce and pricey, so the deluxe reprint makes sense. There's been a lot of talk on our network of late about Coletta. From everything I read, he wanted to be the Rush guy because he wanted lots of work. He had a pretty extravagant lifestyle by all accounts, so if he could ink 2 books a week, more the better. But of course, he damaged his own reputation and caught the ire of artists like Grell who were saddled with him. I look at Coletta as a slumming actor in lots of ways. Take John Carradine, for instance, fine actor with one of the best voices in the history of motion pictures. But man, he couldn't turn anything down. Yes, all the horror icons slummed a bit, but Carradine would literally do anything for a buck. And although he is finally remembered, it's with the caveat that he was in some true stinkers way beneath him. Coletta could have said, no, I can't do that. I already have a stack of pages to ink, taking his time and turned out great work he was obviously capable of. But he didn't. He wrote that angry letter to the comic industry when Jim Shooter was pushed out of Marvel because Vincent was gravy trained and just derailed. Shooter would give him all the work he could take just to keep those trains running on time. Artistic integrity be damned. The story sounds absolutely bonkers, and in that way, the Legion really was a closer analog to the X-Men than the New Teen Titans. The continuity was almost impenetrable at times. I bought the title sporadically, but I don't think I ever knew what was going on. It was more like, oh, hey, Mon-El's on the cover. I like him. yeah, that's a good comparison, Chris. In fact, I bought X-Men for years. That was a regular book of mine. And then it was at some point in the late 80s, I think, that it dawned on me. I was reading it and I was like, I have no idea what's going on anymore. There were so many storylines and there was like, by that point, there were spinoff books that I wasn't following that I just was like, I don't even know what's going on. And I just dropped the X-Men book and I never went back. And so I think that's with X-Men, it was grandfathered in, but with Legion, it was to me always impenetrable, which is why I never started. Brett Young says, great episode, Rob. Sarah was a delight. Hopefully you'll have her on again soon. Absolutely, Brett. I had this treasure since I was a kid in the 80s. Picked it up at my local comic store. I had always seen ads for it in other comics, so when I saw it, I thought I'd struck gold. It was so cool. The Grell issues were what got me hooked on the Legion. I think it was probably because I was 11 and all the girls were 80% naked. One correction to your discussion. No, Saturn Girl was not in a gown. She was rocking bell bottoms on her wedding day. They came in handy for movement as she and Lightning Lad ran under the laser gun salute being fired about 3 inches over their head. Speaking of the wedding, it's been a while since I read this. I forgot the Lightning Lad's oh well moment was when he was going to commit murder or suicide with his wife on their honeymoon because they were almost out of air. Saturn Girl might want to call Lawyer Lad and check on his space annulment. They threw in some Fun Legion cameos too. The subs, Duplicate Boy, Ron Vidar, who was dressed like a space Maitre D', and the Miracle Machine, which was always this weird-looking Deus Ex Machina that would pop up now and again. My favorite was when Matter Eater Lad actually ate it. That actually happened. That's the second reference to that. I really got to maybe read that story. My favorite part is the history lesson breaking down the order of when the Legionnaires joined. I used to have it memorized when I was a kid. By the way, it was illustrated by James Sherman, who was secretly the best Legion artist. Unfortunately, he only did about 3 issues. Okay. Bilingual Boy Burbage says, what a fun episode, because Sarah clearly loves the Legion, or Rob clearly loves the format, and hates Vince Coletta's inks. I remember seeing the ads for this book and being wowed by the all-grail cover, and then opening the first page to see Coletta, one of my all-time greatest comic book disappointments. Why in the world use the supersized format if you're going to erase the majority of the backgrounds? Ugh. And then finally, Jonathan says, my favorite Treasury comic, just edging out Howard the Duck. I used to try and make Science Police laser rifles out of my Tinker Toys. The best part was the Who's Who entries in the back with Emma Ladd's awesome one-time only Kirby costume and Shrieking Violet hanging out with the 70s alien. Whew, that's a lot of comments for this book. Thanks to everybody who came onto the website and let me know their thoughts about this episode. I'm glad you all enjoyed it. So again, thank you all very much. So that's going to do it for this episode of Treasure Kiss. Huge, huge thanks to the legendary Michael T. Gilbert for being on the show. That was so exciting getting to talk to him. I've been a fan of his stuff for the longest time, and this Topps book is just unreal. It's a little pricey, but if you are a fan of comics history or publishing history, check it out. It is a great read, and I am just so honored that Michael would come on the show to talk about it. This is just, it was just so exciting for me. Again, I've loved his stuff for decades, and it was just really great to talk to him. So again, thank you, Michael, and everybody. At the very least, check out the images on the website, findwaterpodcast.com, to see some of the pages from the Topps book. I think you'll be sufficiently enticed enough to go pick it up on your run. So as I said, that's going to do it for this episode of Treasury Cast. You can find all the back episodes on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking Treasury Comics and Twitter at Treasury Comics. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcasts. And then you're going to unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Jeff Pollier and Brett Young for their support of Treasury Cast. I very much appreciate it. So that, again, is going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you next month. But until then, go big or go home.
Well, the strike isn't over. So I suppose the children have been waiting to hear something about their funnies. Do you like them? Oh, I get a great kick out of them, although it's we can't get them all. So I'll give you some today. Here's Dick Tracy. Let's see what Dick Tracy is doing.